All right. Well, I am going to start to ping some others into the room. Tell us, Richard, how did you come to this topic, and maybe give a little bit of background for those of us who haven't read the ruling itself.
Great. Yes. Now, typically this, I would say, is probably too narrow a topic, you know, a particular court decision. But as we've seen in the last couple of days, we've just got another one, a leak from the Supreme Court about possibly overturning Roe v. Wade. So I may tackle that one later. I love doing legal analysis, constitutional analysis. But the reason I picked this one is I believe it's significant in terms of pushing back on the government's invasions of privacy and bodily autonomy associated with the pandemic and the lockdowns, distancing, masking, all that kind of thing. And this decision did immediately end mask mandates in public transport. So people may remember the week it came out. This is from Judge Kimball Mizell, who's only 37 years old, but really brilliant down in Florida. We saw videos of people on airplanes taking their masks off. So she made that possible. She issued a ruling, and I've read every of the 59 pages, so you don't have to. And so I am going to try to put it in a more philosophic legal context to see whether this is good news for us or not. By us, I mean advocates of the rule of law and liberty. So one way I would put this before I even dive into it is, suppose this is just a procedural versus a substantive decision. In law, procedural versus substantive is the following. Procedure is just the process by which, in this case, the mask mandates or these other measures were implemented. And due process of law, if you're a law student out there or a lawyer, you know, refers exactly to that. There has to be a procedure of either passing laws, applying laws. In the case of regulatory law, which I don't actually think is legitimate, the whole regulatory state, if we could bring that up in the Q&A, that might be interesting. But that's what's at issue here. She was ruling on whether the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, could issue a mask mandate. And they did issue a mask mandate in February 2021, right after Biden was inaugurated. And it was challenged, and she threw it off. She said it's illegitimate. But now on substantive grounds, whenever you say substantive grounds, that's when a lawyer, law judge says you're violating liberties. You're violating basic human rights. You see the idea? So it's not the manner or procedure in which you're doing it, but what actual rights are being violated. Now, if this ruling touched on or was largely based on the second, that would be very relevant. Now, this is a lower district judge in Florida, in mid-Florida. And so some argue that the scope of the ruling isn't that great. However, interestingly, the Biden Justice Department is considering appealing it. Now, if it's appealed and upheld, the ruling would actually have wider consequence and more permanent consequence, because the higher up you go in the chain, I mean, even if it went to the Supreme Court, it could hold out the possibility of us never having to go through this again. So that's the other reason I wanted to analyze this. I wanted to give some kind of forecast of whether this is a leading indicator, because we're going to have public health issues again. We're going to have diseases again. And I think people are probably interested in, are we going to do this all over again? And now that at least we have some legal precedent, we might ask, well, maybe not. Maybe someone will be citing Mizell's decision years from now to prevent it again. Now, interestingly enough, at the very highest level, Supreme Court, three times the Supreme Court was asked to nullify mask mandates, and it didn't. Now, I haven't researched those as much, so I don't know whether they just refused to hear the case, which is not the same thing as, I'm pretty sure that was what it was. They just wouldn't hear the cases for various reasons. So that doesn't mean it's on record validating them. So that's as a little bit of background, just laying out like standards of what we might expect from a decision like this, and whether we could make something of it, or is it just another narrowly construed case that won't have any broader implications. I think this one will have broader implications. I read it hoping it would have more substantive points in it, and it did. It had both, actually. It had procedural and substantive, which is very hard to do at the lower level. The higher you go up in the court system, it's easier to talk about things like human rights and abortion and things like that. It's harder to do it at the lower level where there are usually procedural challenges. Now, another thing I looked for in this was the court citing science? Was it citing facts? Was it citing a certain methodology? And there, I was very pleasantly surprised. This judge, because she was a Trump appointee, has been dismissed as a hack, has been dismissed as an inexperienced, right-leaning. She's also Christian, so they're going after her for that. She also clerked for Clarence Thomas. But this ruling is just festooned with citations and chapter and verse on precedent and prior law. I mean, it's really a headbanger in some cases. It is not a freewheeling, subjective opinion. It is thoroughly anchored and cited in precedent all over the place. So it's a really amazingly done brief ruling. Okay, now let me just say what the plaintiffs are. I was very, and we should be very interested to learn. You always have to have a plaintiff bring these cases. You can't, the court's not going to just sit around, of course. And then it's interesting that the main plaintiff here was a group called Health Freedom Defense Fund. Now I looked it up. Health Freedom Defense Fund was founded by Leslie Manoukian. Now Leslie Manoukian used to work on Wall Street. She has an MBA. She has a stellar background. She did a documentary in 2011 called The Greater Good, which was critical of whether vaccines could be mandated. Now, let me just quote you, because this is really the group that went to this court and said, get rid of the mask mandate. Quote from their website. At Health Freedom Defense Fund, we stand for freedom. We stand for choice. And we stand for the most basic of human rights, bodily autonomy. HFDF asserts that no person, business, institution, organization, or government has the right to force a person to put something into their body against their will. If any of those entities have or claim that power, we are not free and we do not live in a decent, moral, or just society. As has been agreed by all free nations for decades, the practice of ethical medicine requires prior, voluntary, and informed consent. Period. Our leadership, staff, and members all dream of inhabiting a world where the individual and his or her rights are not only acknowledged, but respected above all else. And one of our guiding principles is that two wrongs do not make a right. And any citizen that will sacrifice one of its members in service to the greater good is not a society we want to embrace or support. One of all the basic rights that human beings possess, none is more sacred than that of bodily autonomy. Defense of this most fundamental of human rights is the primary mission of the group. Okay, so that's just as an excerpt if you want to leave there. That group wrote the brief and brought in other members who were directly affected and harmed by the mask mandates. Okay, so here, now let me go through the four main counts of the plaintiffs, which the Judge Mizell took up. Count one, the mask mandate exceeded CDC authority. Now, let me remind you all, notice this is not a challenge to, this case is not a challenge to the whole array of COVID lockdown procedures, because we remember they included stay home, they included social distancing, they included distinguishing essential for non-essential jobs. Remember all that. And mask mandates as well, and mandated vaccines and things like that. This one literally refers only to mask mandates in public transportation. In other words, at the airports, in bus terminals, on buses, and things like that. They tried to extend it to Uber and elsewhere, and surrounding hubs, when you walk into the airport. So, but that's not the judge's fault. The fact that the case brought before her was trying to get rid of those mask mandates and not the whole array of COVID lockdown things is not as important. The mask mandate is this, the mask mandate in public areas was the main thing. Count two was that the CDC improperly invoked what they call the good cause exception. Now, this was an exception that said we can institute this right away without explaining, without showing any data, without having any 30-day public comment period, which is required, absolutely required in agency law. And so basically that they were acting in a way that dismissed this very important procedure. Now, that sounds procedural, right? That is not as substantive. Now, but here's another one. Here's count three. There's only four counts. Count three is the mask mandates violate the APA, which is the Administrative Procedures Act. Again, it sounds procedural, but here's the key, because it's arbitrary and capricious. Now, to me, this is the most interesting and important part of the decision. The idea that the judge basically said the government has been arbitrary and capricious. And she goes on to say, in being arbitrary and capricious, it's violating people's liberties. It's violating people's freedom of behavior and movement. It's not consistent with, quote, our system of government. So this is the part where she pivots to the substantive problems with all this. There's a fourth count. Even if the CDC did not exceed its authority, that Congress improperly delegated its legislative power to the CDC. In this case, the judge was not as willing to go there. Judges are very unlikely to say, hey, Congress, you know, gave undue power to this agency. In this case, they're more likely to say this agency acted recklessly, or this agency acted negligently, or this agency violated these procedures. That's exactly what she ruled. And the minute she ruled, the mask mandates went away in public areas, public transportation areas. So it's very important in that regard. Now, just a couple more things, then I'll leave it to your own thoughts. I'd rather go to the substantive first, because I think it's the most powerful on count three, that the mask mandate was arbitrary and capricious. The plaintiff said the mandate was, quote, substantively unreasonable, substantively so, and, quote, failed to explain the CDC's reasoning. Okay, she goes on to say the court agrees with this. Now, then she says, quote, the court, some of this is her talking, but some of it is just citing prior cases. The court may not substitute its judgment for that of any regulatory agency. The court is limited to ensuring that an agency's exercise of discretion was both reasonable and reasonably explained, unquote. Meaning, quote, when the agency demonstrates acting reasonably is when the agency demonstrates that it engaged in reasoned decision making. Quote, and to do so, quote, the agency must examine the relevant data and articulate a satisfactory explanation for its action, including a rational connection between the facts found and the choice made, unquote, then quoted later. The articulated rationale must also be adequate to explain all major aspects of a decision or a ruling, unquote. The mask mandate, quote, fails this reasoned explanation standard, and that's what she calls it, the reasoned explanation standard, and finishes the ruling with, quote, our system does not permit regulatory agencies to act unlawfully even in pursuit of desirable ends. Now, that phrasing is very, unquote, that phrasing is very interesting, because the desirable ends part refers to substance. And here she's saying, of course, public health is of value. And it's not crazy, she's implying, that there be an agency called the CDC, which has the desirable and or goal of preserving public health. But then notice in the prior part of the sentence, she says, but regulatory agencies cannot act unlawfully in pursuit of that. And here what she's basically saying is you did act unlawfully in pursuit of this. So there are other things I could say about this, but it's a ruling. It's a very well reasoned, well argued, well substantiated ruling, which largely focuses on procedural, but also has this nice section saying, you know, it's not just about procedural niceties here. The purpose of having rational, predictable, legitimate procedures is precisely to protect the substance of the freedoms. And she has many passages in here talking about how liberties and in some cases dignities are violated by this mandate. And there's many, many passages which totally tears apart how unscientific the CDC was and inconsistent and hypocritical in saying, the masks had to be universal, and yet there were these exceptions, and you could drink coffee and others didn't have to. And she really exposes the complete arbitrariness and non-scientific basis of the mask mandates. There's also a clever section where the CDC and the court sends something like, we're invoking the 1944 Act, which established the Public Health Administration. And the 1944 Act had in there justifications for restricting people's movements and doing things like sanitizing or fumigating or exterminating pests or even destroying animals and things like that. And believe it or not, the CDC and others literally invoked that for the mask mandate. And Mizell points out quite interestingly, she said, masks sanitize nothing. Sanitize means cleaning things. Sanitizing means getting rid of existing disease, existing contaminated people. And she makes very clear, and I think this could be the most philosophic part of it, you do not restrict or quarantine healthy people. You do not presume, this is a presumption of innocence argument, you do not presume that someone's going to be a danger to others universally. You have to identify those who are sick and that their sickness has a possible material effect on others. And by that standard, you would never issue a mask mandate. You would never do a mask quarantine, in fact. Ayn Rand wrote about this or talked about it. The idea of a mask quarantine, meaning a quarantine even of those not designated as sick. And that might be a high standard in terms of demonstrating. But without that, there's absolutely no liberty at all from these public health control freaks. So that's an interesting section, too, for those lawyers in the room and law students who want to take a look at it. I'll just finish by saying I'm on record from the beginning, meaning spring of 2020, for believing and suspecting and investigating that the whole reaction to COVID was authoritarian, was improper, was arbitrary, was capricious. I think Donald Trump himself did himself no favor by declaring this as an emergency, as he did in March of 2020. But interestingly, one of the things Mizell points out is when he did that, and I think 2 months later, the Department of Health and Human Services did the same, there was no mask mandate coming from the CDC. So they didn't even have a mask mandate until January of 2021, right after Biden's inaugural. So I think the judge also suspects that the thing was political, that the CDC felt that it could be more authoritarian once Biden was in power. She didn't say it that way. She just said it makes no sense for the CDC to have rushed in with this mandate, to have no public comment, to claim that it was doing so because the matter was urgent, and yet it was acting 12 months after the Trump administration did. So, I'm happy to see this. That's one of the things that got me interested in it. I have been very disappointed over the last 2 years with the authoritarian aspect of the whole reaction to COVID, the lockdowns and things like that. And frankly, I've been quite surprised that within our own camp, among Friends of Liberty, there have been some perfectly okay and willing to endorse not only some of the authoritarian measures, but to welcome things like bailout money. So I'll stop there and take questions or comments.
Excellent, Richard. I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but you raise some good points there. I want to encourage those who are in the room, first and foremost, raise your hand if you want to ask Professor Salzman a question about Judge Mizell's ruling, or even about what's going on with the Supreme Court today, or other topics. And please do me a favor, share the room, use that little share button at the bottom. But why don't I start with either Scott or Lawrence, if you have any questions.
Yeah, this is almost more of a comment, but I mean, I'm glad that she ruled the way that she did, but I think, you kind of alluded to the fact that the political climate was such that I don't think someone could have gotten away with it, you know, a year and a half ago, trying to do that. And, you know, there just would have been such a backlash. And I'm glad that, you know, there's at least enough mask fatigue now that, I mean, those cheers, I mean, it just shows it was like a kind of moment for freedom.
I agree with that, Scott. I think it was a lot easier, if you will, for her to make this decision now. She did cite in the ruling, though, that CDC had been knocked down twice previously. One on the, if you remember it, one was the ruling that landlords could not demand payment from renters, the moratorium on rent paying. That was a CDC imposed, and that was overthrown, not by Mizell, but by another court. And there was another thing that the CDC mandated that I can't quite remember right now that was also thrown out. So that was earlier as well. So I agree with that. But the other thing you might conclude positively about this is, and the New York Times actually has an article complaining about this, written 3 days after Mizell's, how the hell could this thing have been done with, you know, a small special interest group who wants freedom in healthcare? You know, a couple of plaintiffs who felt anxiety on the plane by putting on a mask. I mean, that is literally who the plaintiffs were. This was not a huge class action lawsuit. I think it, and one of the reasons I wanted to, you know, hat tip to Health Freedom Defense Fund is how much can be done with so little. So far as I can tell, this is not a huge, you know, philanthropy, but they really have the right ideas. I mean, that's why I read them off to you. So a principled broad view about bodily autonomy, bringing to bear and going into having some legal acumen to know, well, where can we challenge this? Oh, well, it's in the Tampa District Court because there's more conservatives there. You know, this is the way you do it. This is the way the other side does it. They find their friendly judges, however you want. It's an unfortunate part of the system, but it doesn't mean this particular ruling wasn't objective. So I think Friends of Liberty should also take this case, not just as a, you know, as reading her ruling, but as to the background of how this case came about and how, you know, how consequential this small little Health Freedom Defense Fund was and worked, and look into Leslie Manoukian. I mean, I think she might even be worth interviewing Atlas Society for the broader issue of, well, what else is Health Freedom Defense Fund trying to do? And when they talk about things like bodily autonomy, I don't know this for a fact, but might they be consistent, as we do not see consistency, in saying, well, a woman's right to choose on abortion is also bodily autonomy? As you know, the right will say we get to restrict a woman's right to choose on abortion, and the left will say we get to restrict a woman on vaccine. Well, what about a libertarian objectivist approach that says you're both wrong? Maybe that's where they're going. It'd be interesting to know. So, but I agree with you, Scott. It's a bit late in the game, but it's still a good decision.
I like the idea of having some maybe strange bedfellows to make a common cause. I was thinking about that with regards to Roe versus Wade. You know, it seems that those who are upset about it being overturned are pursuing strategies like ending the filibuster or packing the court, or just, you know, flat out intimidating the sitting justices. But I thought, well, you know, we have Howie Rich and Citizens for Term Limits trying to get a constitutional convention. So maybe they should get together with the pro-choice activists and put a couple of items on the agenda. So anyway, Clark.
Yes, Richard, thank you so much for doing all the background work.
You're welcome. Like
now we don't have to do it like you were saying, but I was going to ask, though, I haven't really looked into this much at all, but now, is there any kind of a private-public dichotomy that this ruling brought up, because, you know, of course, today, you know, most objectivists, we kind of get the public-private thing right, but you know, even a lot of conservatives don't. And of course, you know, today with all these woke corporations, I mean, I live down here in woke Austin, Texas, where, I mean, you can just see the masks are almost like a cultural thing where any company or well, even the local, you know, the local municipal governments are all pretty blue. You know, of course, the governor's red, you know, Republican. So the whole mask thing is almost like a proxy war between, you know, red and blue. So I'm just wondering now, does this ruling take up that issue at all?
Well, I think it does in the sense that it is trying to limit the scope of regulatory reach. And if by that, you know, we mean public entering private sphere, yes, it's a small little objection from the peanut gallery, if you will. But that's why I'm hoping it actually is challenged. I hadn't thought of this until I saw a CNN analyst saying, asked, will this be appealed? And he didn't like the ruling. And he said, I hope it's not appealed, because if it's upheld, we will never be able to mandate in the way we just did. Well, that is very revealing, isn't it? Quite revealing. Yes. And I found a public health law professor from UCLA, Wiley, who said, if this stands, I'm quoting him now, if this stands, there would be no ability for the federal administrative agencies to regulate interstate transit in a public health emergency. Congress would have to authorize all that first, unquote. So you see how the control freaks, the authoritarians, are shaking in their boots. They really do not want this seemingly narrowly construed decision, although it was at the CDC, and the CDC is a federal level agency. They really do not want any higher courts to rule in favor of her. And I looked it up, and apparently the next level of appeal would be at a level that is also heavily, it's the 11th appeals district. That group is also conservative. So they would probably affirm what she said. And I think this is very important for, as I said, future cases. I thought it was really quite unfortunate, actually. This will sound weird, but we were coming upon the second anniversary in March or so of this year of the lockdowns and mandates and things like that. And I thought it was a perfect opportunity to do these retrospectives on what worked and what didn't work. And it never happened. The Ukraine-Russia thing happened in mid-February. And if you remember, it was all that the whole, even Fauci wasn't showing up anymore. The whole attention shifted to the next crisis. And I don't think, our side had a chance to say, okay, let's conclude here. This was a complete disaster. This isn't going to happen again. Never again. Here's why. The John Hopkins study that came out with Steve Hanke was great. This ruling, this kind of thing. And so we need to be aware of these and look at these. Otherwise, the public reach will continue to be enormous. On a broader philosophic level, Clark, I hinted earlier, I don't know if this interests you or some objectivists, this could be a whole future talk. I think the whole regulatory apparatus is wrong. I think the court system, the civil court system, should handle wrongs where people do torts against each other, including spreading diseases to each other, especially if they do it knowingly. But I'll just someone needs to mute. Yeah, I just think the whole regulatory state has the presumption of guilt. It basically says, you're not really guilty, but we think you might do something. So we're going to regulate your behavior so that you don't do something. And to me, that is just a complete inversion of British and American Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence, that you have to be presumed innocent until proven guilty. And I think the case could be made that the entire regulatory state, I mean everything called the alphabet agencies, like the CDC and the FDA and the FCC and the EPA, they all have that premise behind them. And secondly, they're very dangerous because they involve no separation of powers. They involve literally rulemaking, which is legislation. They have hearings and courts. The IRS has a tax court, so they also act as judiciary. And then they have penalties. They can penalize you. They can fine you. They can jail you. So the regulatory agencies are an exception also to the rule that there should be a separation of powers along executive, legislative, and judicial branches. But that's for another time. But in this case, the CDC is an example of that. You have a jurist willing to restrain them.
Excellent. Clark, did that do it for you?
Yes. Thank you again, Richard. And maybe if there's time later, of course, you'll be able to address the abortion, the leak or whatever that's called.
Yeah, I could do that. I could do that now if you wish. First of all, on the leak, I think, by the way, remember that Justice Breyer's retirement was leaked as well. Was it 2 months ago, 3 months ago? So this is a very bad precedent, no pun intended, in the court, a bad precedent. It verges on the Banana Republic type stuff. I mean, the court has rules, and the idea that this kind of thing would be leaked by anyone, I'm guessing something like a clerk for one of the justices who didn't like the drafted opinion. So that alone, I mean, if they don't get to the bottom of it, but I don't know if they got to the bottom of the leak of Breyer's retirement, which you could say, well, that wasn't any big thing. Yeah, but it might have, but it probably rushed the process of picking the replacement, and you don't want that happening. You really don't want that. But the idea of kind of mob rule, and we're going to tell the Supreme Court what to do, and even if we're an insider, we don't like what it's about to do, we're going to leak it to get our groups going and get them all agitated. I mean, it's a continuation of a kind of populist, emotionalist, mob rule attitude we have today, going all the way back to the summer of 2020 with Antifa, BLM, and everyone burning the place down and looting. And some of that stuff's still going on, and defund the police and all that. There's a discernible trend in America against the rule of law. There just is. There's a definitive trend toward what I call the rule of lawlessness. That as long as the mob wants it, everything else gets to be swept away, including the mores and the etiquette of procedures of the Supreme Court releasing opinions. This is unheard of, to release a draft opinion. And now procedurally also, I would say, think about this. The five, Alito's name is on it, so it doesn't show the other four, but you can guess who the other four are. Thomas and Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett and Gorsuch. Yeah. So three of the five are Trump appointees. So this incenses the other side to no end. Now, before I even say what the decision might mean, that the idea that those five, where are they going to go every day and not feel like they're going to be killed? I mean, there's some crazy people out there. People see what just happened to Dave Chappelle. The five justices who would rule on this in favor are targets. And maybe the leaker knew that. I'm sure they have security. I'm sure they come and go from the, maybe they're not even in the building anymore. And that alone is sad. Are they doing all this remotely? We live in an age where you get to dox people you don't like, meaning reveal where they live, where their kids are, their phone numbers and stuff. I fear for the five justices who appear to be on the side of reversing Roe v. Wade. And that's disgusting. And maybe the leaker knew that. It's disgusting. And yes, Jag mentioned earlier, in the background, were they already in the last year or so talking about packing the court? Yes, packing the court. They packed the court in Venezuela. They went from 9 to 27 judges. This is what you do when the tyrants take over. The tyrants take over, and the move to tyranny is so fast, they just cannot put up with these old fogies who were put on the court years ago. So they need to dilute their vote. If you can't kill them, add others to the mix and dilute their vote into nothingness and put your cronies in. And this is being done, largely on the Democrat side. They're the advocates of this. They don't like who won the election, that he put three people on the court, so they want to expand the court. It is brazen arbitrariness. It's brazen power grab. All right, so that on that, just the security of the five. And then someone saying, well, then they better issue it soon so they're not at risk. You realize if one of them is killed or maimed, the decision can't go through. But the reason I'm mentioning this is not to be I don't mean to be dramatic about this, but it's, I looked into this. It's a fact that if a justice was killed and you now had 4-4, the decision wouldn't go through. So there is a motivation for some crazy person to do something to a justice to make sure this decision doesn't go down. And if the solution to that is get the decision out tomorrow, well, that's ridiculous too. If you look at the front page of the draft, it says this is a draft. If you find any typos or misstatements or wrong citations, you know, alert us to it. So, you know, why would you issue something that isn't, that hasn't been finalized, hasn't been totally fixed? Now, as to the decision itself, it's always this way. If you're a friend of liberty, you just shake your head on left and right. On the left, they're saying a woman has a right to choose, and that's my view. I agree. But I also agree that Roe v. Wade was ridiculous. It was just a ridiculous way to do it. I do believe, actually, there's a right to privacy. Some of the best work on the right to privacy is Amy Peacock. She has specialized this in law school. So just look up Amy Peacock, right to privacy. But on the right, they're saying, well, of course, abortion is murder. But they're not going so far as to say, good, then put everyone in jail who's a part of it, including the woman, by the way, not just the doctor, it'd be the woman who's an accomplice to the murder of her own quote-unquote baby. They never say that. They never say, are you willing to prosecute the woman? But maybe the most disturbing part of it and disappointing part of it is the idea of states' rights. So the conservative side have always said, well, let the states decide. Well, if you're truly principled about this, if abortion is truly murder, why do you care whether Virginia does it and, you know, California does it and Virginia doesn't? I mean, you would say nobody should be able to do it. And they're also invoking democracy. So that you got Republicans saying, hey, aren't you for democracy? I'm for democracy. Let people, Tucker Carlson said this the other night. I was flabbergasted, a really bad argument. That people who oppose this going back to the states and having them decide whether a woman has a right to reproductive choice or not, according to Tucker, that's democracy. That's people voting. Well, you and I know that if people truly have rights, they're not subject to vote. They shouldn't be subject to vote. That's what the Bill of Rights is about. Congress shall pass no law abridging freedom of speech and of the press, right? Not, well, it can abridge some of these if we get a majority vote. So I guess the last, I don't want to go on too long about this, not really the topic of the day, although jurisprudence is. I think the last thing I'll say is apparently when Roe v. Wade was judged in 1973, something like 30 states in the country banned abortion, but 20 didn't. And fast forward to now, someone was doing a tally, because who would think of doing a tally of where the states stood if it's all, unless it's all going to go back to them. And apparently it's the reverse. But there's, in other words, there'll be, I don't know, how did I say it the first time? 30 banned and 20 allowed. Now it's 20 allowed and 30 would ban it or something like that. So, but their argument is, well a woman can still move, you know, from Mississippi where they ban it to California where they don't, you know, to get her abortion. The whole argument is that I'm so unprincipled. But my view generally is, as with the 14th Amendment, if a right is truly a right, no state can violate it. The Supreme Court and the federal level simply cannot allow, this is the point of the 14th Amendment, by the way. The 14th Amendment basically said all the states have to obey all the other amendments. Prior to that, the Bill of Rights applied only to the federal government. But after the Civil War, of course, you'd have to say, well, you have a bunch of states violating basic liberties. And so same thing here. On the first level, you have to decide whether abortion is a right or not. If it is, you don't quibble at all about what level of government is violating it. You don't allow any level of government to violate it. Lastly, I'll say, I think it's almost impossible or unlikely that if this is issued, which would be in June, I think, I've read the case, so I can see what it means. And if it goes back to the states, which is really what Alito is saying, one alternative, and Schumer is talking about this, is to just negate the whole thing by having Congress pass a law. I mean, even the conservatives years ago said that. Instead of Roe v. Wade, if this were done legitimately, it would be done through the congressional, you know, legislative process. And Schumer now and the others, Bernie Sanders and others, are basically saying, good, that's what we'll do now. And I suppose that would be more legitimate procedurally than the Supreme Court making law from the bench. But I also think it's illegitimate substantively, because even if the U.S. Congress and Senate did it, they should not be passing a law violating women's rights. So they would need 60 votes for that. And the Democrats, and they don't have 60 votes. And so their last plunge would be to get rid of the filibuster. That's why they're trying to get rid of the filibuster. I think that's very unlikely, because Manchin, Sinema, and two or three other Democrats just oppose the idea of getting rid of the filibuster in any debate. And that's a good thing. There being a higher hurdle for Congress doing that. But understand what I'm saying. I want a higher hurdle here, because I can see the Congress, the Democrats, itching to do this at a federal level. On the other hand, I sympathize, because I want the women's right to choose protected. So I hope that's not too confusing.
Thanks.
Well,
for that.
Richard,
thank you.
What would be the solution then to protect women's right to terminate a pregnancy?
I was thinking the other day that I asked myself that the other day, and of all the worst combinations, I think the best would be that's practicable now is the federal legislature saying it. Yes, just drawing up a law, but ideally, it would be in the Constitution. I hate to put more stuff in the Constitution, like, you know, blacks are citizens too and have a right to vote. I didn't hate that. I liked that. I mean, but it's almost like an admission of we haven't recognized these rights before. And so it would be at a higher level to put it in the Constitution, just something short that says, you know, Congress shall pass no law, you know, restrictive of women's right to do with her body what she, you know, however you put it. That would really, but that requires the whole thing of, two-thirds states propose, three-quarters of the states approve, you know, that kind of stuff, big hurdle stuff, but actually not substantially more of a hurdle than if the Congress did it and required 60%, because 60% is considered a super, what they call a super majority. It's not just 50% plus one. It's a, quote, super majority, either two-thirds or three-quarters, and that's what the Constitution requires. So short of a constitutional amendment preserving this right, the next best would be, yes, in reaction to what the Supreme Court does, the federal Congress somehow passes a law and requires the states to abide by the law. And then you rely on what's called the Supremacy Clause in the U.S. Constitution, which says no state law can violate, can be in contradiction to federal law.
But can you use your rights argument to, you know, The whole laboratories of democracy, can you say that, oh, no state can outlaw gambling, or, you know, how far can that go?
Well, that's a good question. I'll defer on that for now. That's a very good question, though, Lawrence, because if you go from, you know, right to life, liberty, property, the pursuit of happiness, and then you get down into the weeds of, well, the pursuit of my happiness is gambling. And prostitution and taking heroin. And of course, the consistent case would be to say, so long as you're not harming others, you should be free to do it. And any state that violates it, against federal law, violates it. Now, it doesn't require the federal government to weigh in on everything, of course. Notice how it happened with legalization of marijuana, by the way. It happened state by state. I think that was the same thing on euthanasia. And same-sex marriage and other things, right? So certain states, and you would expect this, right? Because there's a more variety of opinion among the states. So some seemingly eccentric right, comes out, and the federal Congress doesn't jump on it right away, but states do. And sometimes they can accelerate the process and get it into the courts, and that happened with same-sex marriage. First, California, of all places, California actually had a vote and disallowed same-sex marriage. And so when was it upheld? In Obergefell, in the Supreme Court did it. 9 unelected judges extended the right on same-sex marriage. But it's a good question, Lawrence. I'm a big fan of federalism, so don't get me wrong. I don't want everything pressed down from on high from Washington, forcing every state to do the same thing. But on basic rights, on basic fundamental rights, and that's why I'm saying it here. I mean, this is a big one. This is a big one, a woman's right to control her own body. And I hope you realize that this is a whole nother thing, but I'm generally of the view that we do not have a human being with rights that the state should protect until there's birth. And so it's very troubling for me to hear conservatives talking about things like baby in the womb, or even the president the other day talked about aborting a child. I mean, so Biden doesn't even know what he's talking about, what these concepts mean. I mean, if you go on the timeline, if you will, you have, say, zygote, embryo, fetus, and then birth, right? And then bright line there, birth. And then after that, you have baby, infant, child, adolescent. Okay. So that is the Maginot line, or whatever you want to call that line. You can't start mixing up the terms and talk about things like a fetus driving a bike down the street or a baby in the womb. It's just messed up conceptualization. And the conservatives, I think, are most guilty of it because they talk about things like baby in the womb. If there was really a baby in the womb, then it would be murder. And if you look up murder, it says the killing of a human being by a human being. Well, I would not classify a zygote, an embryo, or a fetus as a human being. So that's for those of you interested in more like the biological aspects of it and when does life begin. There is life in conception. There is obviously there's an organism. Those three things are organism. But that is a equivocation on life. What we're talking about is when does human life begin? And human life begins at birth, in my view.
Connie, I knew you wanted to get in.
Oh, thanks. Just a couple of comments, you know, a little pushback on that.
Okay.
I disagree somewhat with whom you think would automatically of the justices be voting. I think Gorsuch would not. I don't think he would go for that's just because he's a Trump appointee. But that's only one matter with that. The other matter, you know, when it comes to all of this is the fact remains that they're doing this decision because they believe it shouldn't have ever been
right.
Buddhist decision to begin with.
Right.
And I don't disagree with that. You know, good ideas don't require force.
Yes. So yeah.
Hopefully, I've heard just there's millions of conversations going on with this right now that it helps to bring some solutions to the issue in spite of where you think you may fall on the side of that. So I hope good comes from it. What gets me is that, you know, this was leaked at the time when there's primaries and
yeah,
and all these things going on. And the other elephant in the room is the Ministry of Truth. So
yes, right.
So I have comments. I had the comments I made about the issue you were speaking of, but my question would actually be what are your feelings about this Ministry of Truth and why why they're why yes. You know, they bring this out at the opportune time to follow the red dot on the SCOTUS decision, and no one's talking about Ministry of Truth. So what do you think about it?
I think I'm glad you brought this up. The Ministry of Truth thing, or whatever they call it, the disinformation governing, is the worst thing and the most important thing right now. Does that sound like I'm overstating it? More important than Russia, Ukraine, more important than the leak of Roe v. Wade, you know, or not just the leak, even if Roe v. Wade were thrown back to the states, because this is free speech. And if you don't have free speech, you got nothing. You really have nothing. This is the first part of the First Amendment. And if this thing isn't stopped right now, I fear for this country. I mean, I've already been fearing for this country for the last 2 years or so, really the last 20 years when we took a move to the right, fascistically, not to the right. It's terrible. It's awful. And I'm not sure it's triggered by these other things that are going on, like sleight of hand, look over here, because the Department of Homeland Security has been brazen about admitting it and being in front of Congress and talking about it. And someone even brought up how bad the
person running it will be. And the head of the department said, she's great. She's just actually awful. I think it might be in response to Elon Musk taking over Twitter. I'm guessing here, but I think prior to that, this government, and I mean this regime, not the American government, but this particular regime, and I call them all regimes now. There's no more administrations. I hate to say it. The U.S. is going very illiberal, and they're all just different regimes now. They were using Twitter and others to censor. And I know the more libertarian objectivist view would be, these are private companies. They can't really censor. They do have a right to say who was on their platforms. And I'm sympathetic to that view, actually. And I originally actually endorsed Section 230, which said you couldn't sue them because they're just platforms. You can't sue them for stuff people say on their platforms. But that only, and that would be like saying you can't sue the phone company just because someone uses the phone to, you know, plan a bank heist. That's always been true. But you could, you know, get the phone records and investigate it after the fact, but you wouldn't punish AT&T. You'd punish the bank robbers. And so, well, suppose all that goes away. Suppose there is this kind of implied censorship by the government being in cahoots with Twitter and social media. They'd be very worried if the thing went private. And they'd be very worried, especially if it went private to a guy who's on record saying, I'm for free speech. I don't know whether Elon's a libertarian or not, but on free speech, he certainly is. And so maybe that's why they brushed off something that was on the shelf, you know, a disinformation board. They've been using the words different disinformation, misinformation for quite a while now. That could be the motivation. But the motivation isn't as important as the fact. And here's what I'm looking for. I wonder if you are as well. The more you talk about who's in charge of it, the more we lose. Because I think they want that. I think they want a debate about, well, who's going to head it? See what the premise is? The premise is it's okay to have it. Let's just get a reasonable person doing it. The person, I won't even name, Nina Jankovic is her name, is just crazy. And a fomenter of disinformation. I mean, so it's almost like they purposely pick someone who's the worst disinformation spreader ever. I mean, she's the one who said the Russia did the, you know, collusion was true. And that Hunter laptop was not true. I mean, she is Miss Disinformation. That's what she is. And they put her in charge of it. So it's almost as if they're purposely putting someone in charge who is so ridiculous and so vicious that everyone will focus on her. And then they'll win the debate. Because if a year from now, that agency still exists, but it's headed by someone nobody can even name anymore, that's terrible. Because the agency will still exist. So people have to stand up, call it what you did, Ministry of Truth, which I think you're taking right out of Orwell, right, 1984, and just say, this is not going to happen. Whatever senators, I think the best probably are Cruz, Mike Lee, and Rand Paul, and the others have to stand up and say, this is not going to stand. We're not going to allow this. I think Josh Hawley said he would defund it. I'm not really sure that's the best way. It can't exist at all. You can't just defund it and leave it because then the subsequent Congress will fund it. This is a really principled thing. And that, as an economist, you would think I would care more about the mask ruling or the price controls and all the other things I've brought up recently, which are important. But this one, I'm glad you brought it up because in the context of what we're talking about today, including issues of war and peace, that's pretty big too. That's maybe number two. That was number one on my list until I heard about this censorship bureau. Now I would rank the biggest dangers to our liberty, the censorship bureau, the possibility that everyone wants to get us into World War III, or seemingly everyone, but me, Tucker Carlson, and four other people in the world, I don't know, four other people. And in the background, the potential of inflation becoming hyperinflation.
Well, arguably, just a little pushback with that, putting her into that position, something... Yeah. I've done all through time, or we've seen all through time. We call it pushing trash. Whether you vote them, promote them, whatever you do, get them out of there.
Yeah.
So I'll use Kamala Harris as an example.
Yeah.
Putting her where she is was putting her in the least powerful position she's in right now. So putting her in that position, everybody's, oh, you know, whatever side they're on, they're all I'll say, you know, no, she can't do that, or they can all agree with it as long as it's the person they like.
Yeah.
Just executive orders, you know, a lot of people were off for Trump's orders. I'm like, well, just wait, next administration, you're not going to like it. That's the problem with executive orders. But I call it pushing trash. Putting her in that position just actually gives her less power. So
interesting. Okay. Well, I think my other interpretation, I think I might agree with that. My other interpretation is it's very revealing what agency they put this in. So Department of Homeland Security, what is the Department of it was formed after 9/11. I mean, it's formed after the terrorist attack. And its shift in the last couple of years has been, well, the major threat is internal, not external. Domestic terrorism. And how do they define that? Any Trump supporter. I mean, this is really getting nasty. This is getting really ridiculous. And that's what it's going to be used for. It's going to be used to silence a political opposition. It's going to create political dissidence. And it's going to actually cause such anger that there'll be more political dissidents, but they have good reason, because their truth has been called mistruth. I mean, that is the pattern of the last couple of years. People telling the truth have been canceled and smeared and ostracized, and then later found out to have been telling the truth. And the people who told blatant lies and had whole, investigative councils, like, and two impeachments on various claims, they were proved to have pushed falsehoods. But again, even here, I put it this way, DHS is a law enforcement agency. Even if this was done in something like the FCC, I said to someone the other day, they said, well, what would be a more innocent censorship bureau? And I said, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, right? Because they cover media, TV, false advertising, stuff like that. It sounds more like a false advertising board. Only it would still be bad, because now instead of saying the toothpaste, you know, was falsely advertised, now they'd be saying your campaign is falsely advertised, or your coverage of Ukraine is falsely advertised, and we get to come out against you. But no, they put it in Department of Homeland Security, which is a place full of weapons and law enforcement officers who are weaponized and people who can put you in jail, and then it'll lead to what we know always happens: self-censorship, the kind of silent behind the scenes where people just don't say anything and don't shut up and don't congregate and ally with other, say, liberty lovers for fear of being tagged right-wing extremists and white supremacists who are in MAGA country. I mean, the other day, the president literally referred to MAGA Nation, which I assume means all Trump supporters, which I assume means 75 million people, as extremists. I mean, even on a political spectrum, extreme is never 71 million people. It's the people on the fringes. And that would be something like Antifa or BLM, or maybe some of the people who rioted on January 6th. But the extremists, by definition, are a small fraction of the population. But
thank you. Well, we just have one more minute. Patrick, did you have a quick question?
It isn't quick, so maybe you should go with another one. Hello, did you hear me?
Yeah, that's fair. Lawrence, did you have a quick one?
Unfortunately not. It's another long one.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. And wow, this was really a terrific session. Thank you, Professor Salzman. Thank you, Clark, Liberty, for your great insights and questions. And we will see you next week. We've got a bunch of different clubhouses. Robert Trzynski is actually going to take on the abortion question on Tuesday. And then we have Stephen Hicks as well coming up. So check out the events section of our website, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you all. Thank you, Jay.